Welcome to another message of hope from Gateway Church Australia. For more information or to contact us, please visit gateway.asn.au.
Good morning, everyone. As Marcy said before, my name is Trav, and I'm part of the Count No Fear leadership team here at Gateway. And I also lead a life group with my wife, Kirsty. And for those of you who do know me, this is proof that I do own a pair of pants and some shoes. So when Marcy first asked me to do this this story, I was pretty excited because I've read it 100 times over the year and never understood it. And I mean, on the surface level, you've got a pretty simple story of Jesus' healing power, this incredible power. He comes across to this new area that he hasn't been before. He's greeted by this demon-possessed man. He drives out these demons into this herd of pigs and off they go into their watery tomb. And the locals there then ask him to leave because they're scared, but he's also just killed their bacon supply for a couple of years. Anyone who loves bacon knows that's disaster. When you begin to delve into the details of the story, you start to understand a little bit more context. So let's start with that. Well, Jesus has cast out demons before, so why does Mark specifically add this story in as well? So firstly, let's look at where this story takes place. It says in the book of in Mark that it goes to the area of Gerasenes. There's a bit of conjecture exactly where it was, but it's in the Decapolis, which is a series of 10 cities right on the edge of the Roman and Greek frontier, on the eastern frontier there, in the heart of the Jewish area of Israel, where Jesus spent most of his time. And it's also important to know who lived in the area. So given it was Greek, Greco-Roman area, there was a majority of the Greek and Roman culture, not necessarily the Jewish culture that was prevalent in that area most of the time. And these people that lived there were non-Jewish people, or the Bible calls them the Gentiles. So they didn't have any concept of who this Messiah was and what he was going to do for the Jews, and they didn't have his concept of a single God. As you know from Roman and Greek mythology, they've got multiple gods. So there's the context of where this story is and who lives there. And that's quite significant when you look at the detail we'll go into in a sec. So when I was reading the story for the 101st time, there was one aspect of the story which actually popped out to me, which I hadn't really noticed before. It says in verse 18, so after Jesus heals the man, the Bible tells us in verse 18 that he's begging Jesus to go with him. We saw that in the story. Jesus is on the boat and the man is begging with him to go. And he asked him to go with Jesus' entourage. But then a surprising answer comes. Jesus tells him, no, stay where you are. Jesus tells him to go home to your family and your friends and tell everyone what God has done for you. And I find this very intriguing on a couple of levels. The first reason I find it intriguing is that multiple times in the Bible, God calls someone out and says, come follow Jesus, come follow me, leave everything behind and follow me. And he gets rejected on multiple occasions. And yet this man is begging to come with him and follow him. And Jesus says, no, stay here and stay where you are. And the second thing is that so many times in the Bible, where in the Gospels, where Jesus heals a man or does something for a man, he says, stay silent. Don't tell anybody about what we've done for you. Or stay silent, only tell the priests to show you're clean and those sorts of things. But it says, don't tell anybody. Yet he tells this man to tell his family and everyone what God has done for him. So why is this the case? Jesus has somebody completely and utterly committed to following him, throwing himself at his feet, saying, take me, and he turns him away. Or so it seems. We've got to remember where this man lived. He lived in the Decapolis, Greco-Roman area, heavily non-Jewish, saturated with Gentiles, those who don't know God. When we understand this, the reason he seems to turn the man back becomes quite obvious. Jesus wants the man to go back and tell those who don't know about God, about God. He wants this man to tell everybody what Jesus has done for him and what Jesus can do for them. The story tells us that the locals of the Decapolis asked him to leave. So Jesus could no longer preach in that area. He couldn't do it anymore because he ruined it with the bacon. He would need somebody else to do it on his behalf. And this man was the somebody that he needed to do it for him. All Jesus had to do was plant the seed in one person's life and allow it to grow in that area. And he planted it in this renewed and healed man, and God would make it grow. In an earlier chapter of the book of Mark, Jesus tells his disciples that the kingdom of God is like a mustard seed, which is the smallest seed going around. Yet when planted and cultivated and watered and grown, it becomes the biggest in the garden, sheltering other trees and plants. This is what he was aiming to achieve by commanding this man to remain in the Decapolis and preach the word there on his behalf. He wanted the seed of his message to grow, the seed of message of hope to grow in that region. And I feel like this has been so relevant to me over the years in so many different ways. Anyone who knows me knows I'd love to work for the church, especially like in terms of formal capacity. And I'd love to work here full time. And I've even had sort of more informal conversations about what that would look like. And who knows what might change in the future. But right now, every time I go down that path, I just feel God saying no. No, Jesus is saying no to me. He's told me to go into my world and be the mustard seed in my community. So I work in head office for one of the major banks in Australia, so it's been a pretty big year for us, but I work in head office in the corporate world in there. And I can tell you that sometimes I'm reminded of the place that that man lived and the people he lived with. In the corporate world, Jesus is not known. He's not well known at all when he doesn't reign supreme. And it's really hard to find people in there who do know who he is. Now, quick side note, I know a lot of people in this room, a lot of people out there work in the corporate world, love Jesus and do what they can for him. So that's awesome. But every one of those guys will also know that I'm right when it says it's very hard to find someone in that space who knows who Jesus is and he doesn't reign supreme. So he's asked me to go into the corporate world and to spread his message of hope among the people that I'm with because he can't do it without me. Do I get it right all the time? Nah. I'll probably get it wrong more often than I get it right. But that's where he's called me to be. So what about you? Where is Jesus asking you to take the seed that he's planted in you? Is it your workplace? Is it your schools? Is it your families? Or is it your sporting clubs, your cricket club, your footy club? All those sorts of places. So just one final thought on this story before we move on to the video for the next one. It's very interesting to note in the first verse of this next section of the story, it says that Jesus went back across the lake. Now, it doesn't say that he went somewhere new. It says he went back across the lake. So it says to me he went back to where he'd just come from. So what interesting to note here is that Jesus went across the lake to this area to save and heal this one man, knowing in advance that he would be rejected by the locals and head back to plant his seed into one willing messenger. The question I have for you is, will you be that messenger?
Hey! Hey, family. I say family this morning because I believe it's really important that we acknowledge whether today is your first time here or you feel like you're part of the furniture. We are a family. My name is Laura, if I haven't met you before, and I'm part of our fantastic youth team at Gateway. I'm also a high school teacher, so if this starts to feel like you're in a year 10 English class, I checked with my students, and trust me, that's a good thing. I'd like to talk to you about invisibility this morning. Turn to the person next to you and tell them what you would do if you had the superpower of invisibility. Go. Okay, let's hear some answers. What would we do if we were invisible? What would we do? What would we do if we were invisible? You'd read? Oh, that's good. Did we have any other answers? What we'd do if we were invisible? Come on, youth. Sorry? Wow, I was thinking we might get something like sneak into the movies, but thanks, Morgan. So when we think about invisibility, we tend to think about the Fantastic Four or the Avengers kind of superpower. But I want to talk today about the kind of invisibility that sucks, the kind that leaves us feeling kind of empty inside. The dictionary, I told you I was an English teacher, actually defines the word invisible as unable to be seen. You may have experienced this type of invisibility at work, in a meeting where you have something to contribute and you're waiting and waiting for that chance, but it never comes. At a social event, you know what it's like. You're in a crowded room and yet you can't shake the feeling that no one notices that you're there. You could leave and it wouldn't make a difference. Maybe you've experienced this at school. You've had your hand up for ages, busting to answer the question the teacher has asked, and they just don't see you. This kind of invisibility hurts. It hurts our souls. As human beings, we have an innate desire to be visible, to know that we matter, that our existence matters. We're going to look at Mark 5:25. The Bible tells us that there was a woman there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. 12 years. Now, I don't know about any other ladies in the room, but 4 to 5 days is plenty. Thank you very much. It goes on to tell us that she had spent everything she had going to different doctors, and instead of getting better, she had actually gotten worse. What we need to acknowledge about this woman was that in biblical times, when she was bleeding, she was considered unclean, separate from society. She was separated from the church. She was not permitted to go to the synagogue to worship. Remembering that in those times, there was a strong belief that inside those buildings was where the presence of God was. So she had been made completely separate from God. She was the very definition of invisible. And she had been this way for 12 years. Doctors couldn't cure her. She couldn't be part of society. She was invisible. It was easier for everybody to pretend that this woman didn't exist. And then this woman, she hears about Jesus. Further along in the chapter, it tells us that she heard about Jesus and thought to herself, if I can just touch his robe, I can be healed. There are three things that we can take out of this. Firstly, this woman is brave. She is risking so much by approaching Jesus, by being amongst other people in her unclean state. She is risking even further persecution. Secondly, this woman's faith is huge. She believes that just by being in the presence of Jesus, just by touching his robe, she'll be healed. Not might be healed, but she will be healed. The third thing, in my opinion, is much, much sadder. This woman is so accustomed to not being seen, to being invisible, that she does not believe that she is actually worth Jesus' time or words. It almost feels like she doesn't want to bother him, so she's just going to go and touch his robe. That's so sad. While her faith is huge, her self-worth, not so much. The Bible tells us that after she touches Jesus' robe, not only does her bleeding immediately stop, but she feels in her body that she's been healed of this terrible condition. Physically, she has been healed. But Jesus isn't finished. Who in here knows that our God is one of not just physical healing, but also healing of the soul? He is a complete healer, both inside and out. So when Jesus touches him, he realizes that healing power has gone out of him. And when we unpack this just a little, we know that Jesus realizes that this wasn't just some run-of-the-mill crowd pressing against him. He knows exactly what happened. And our disciples. Oh, bless their little leather sandals. They insist, look at the crowd around you, Jesus. How can you ask who touched you? But Jesus knows. He knows, just as he knows each and every person in this room, every minute detail about you. He knows who touched him, and he knows why. So then there's this fantastic, awkward pause where Jesus keeps looking around to see who touched him. And we know that he knows who touched him. And the woman comes forward, and she falls at Jesus' feet. This woman, who had been invisible for years, unseen, separated from society. Now, when I first read this, I wanted to know why Jesus waited. Why the awkward pause? Why didn't he just acknowledge her and call her out? And the conclusion that I've come to is that he does call her out, but she needs to respond. He does call her out, but she needs to respond. She needed to physically take that step out. Jesus had healed her physically. He had stopped the bleeding. But in order to heal her soul, she needed to step out. This woman had spent so many years being invisible, feeling like she was worthless, that in order to be seen, in order to bring healing to that part of her soul, she had to be willing to be seen. In order to be seen, this woman had to be willing to be seen. It required a response. She had to step away from the belief that she was insignificant and not worthy of Jesus' time and attention. And when she does, Jesus says to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. Your suffering is over." And with this, Jesus brings her in to the family. Not only does he see her, but he acknowledges her as a daughter. This woman's faith has made her well. And Jesus declares that her suffering is over. It's done. He sees you. And he wants to bring healing into your life, both inside and out. So my challenge for you, Gateway fam, is to think about this week. Whereabouts do you feel unseen? Is it at work? With your friends? With your family? Is it serving in your ministry? How can you bring these parts of your life where you feel unseen, how can you bring them to the feet of Jesus? Thank you. Please join me in welcoming Lucy. I'm so excited to hear from her this morning.
Good morning. Yes, my name is Lucy, and I'm going to start straight up with a confession. I am a late person. They used to call me Last Minute Lucy. I try really hard to be on time, but it just does not happen. And I would love to tell you that this trait occurred because I had two babies under two, but it's been a lifelong affliction. Mostly I'm late for one of two reasons. Either I get distracted talking to people, or I'm sleeping. And both of those things we can find happening in the story today. After Jesus healed the woman, we hear that he continued on to Jairus' house. Jairus was an official in the temple. He was a man of renown, both in the community, both in the Jewish community, but also in the community at large. And we see him, before the woman is healed, begging Jesus to come and heal his 12-year-old daughter. A daughter who is the same age as the woman has been bleeding for. We see him begging, but then we see that he gets told that his daughter has died. He gets told to give up. It would seem that Jesus is too late. But Jesus turns to Jairus in possibly the key verse in Mark 5, and he says, just as Jairus is being pulled into this darkest moment of thinking that he's just lost his precious child, Jesus says, "Don't worry, believe. Don't be afraid, just believe." Just as that news begins to sink into his heart, Jesus jerks him out into a bit of hope. He says, "Trust that I am who I say I am." This is one of those statements that can translate clearly 2,000 years later, right to where you're sitting today. Don't be afraid, just believe. But Jairus came to Jesus expecting, or at least hoping, for a healing. He didn't expect to have to go through the death of his daughter in order to get to that point. You see, when you come to Jesus, he may not take you where you expect to go or where you even want to go. But if you trust him, he will give you far more than you could ever ask or imagine. You see, Jesus is frequently late, but always on time. Jesus is frequently late, but always on time. Time and time again throughout the Bible, there are countless accounts of people who felt that God had forgotten them, that he was simply too late. Many of you here will have known the stories of Abraham or Noah or Joseph or Hannah, all people whose stories attest to the fact that God is frequently late, but always on time. Do you feel like Jesus is too late for you? Do you feel like you've been left on the shelf? Like others' prayers get answered while yours simply get overlooked? Like you may not be worthy of him hearing your deepest needs? Don't be afraid. Just believe. For 12 years, I watched, it's remarkable that it's 12 years given this story, but for 12 years, I watched as most of my friends got married and had babies. For 12 years, I stood single, begging Jesus to answer this one prayer. For 12 years of singleness, I questioned if I'd simply been too bad in my younger years to deserve love. But Jesus was simply late, but perfectly on time. It's very easy to say 5 years into marriage and two children later, but trust me, it was horrible to live through. But just like our stories, Mark's story doesn't stop there. Jesus continues to Jairus' house where mourners are already wailing out the front. He walks past them, telling them to stop, that she is simply sleeping, and they laugh at him. He went into the room with the little girl, with her parents and Peter, James and John. And there's an image up on the screen that I really liked of just what it might have looked like, with the disciples cowering at the door and the parents expectantly at the end of the bed, hoping, and Jesus going up to the little girl and saying to her, "Talitha kum." It's important to note here that these words are recorded in Aramaic, whereas the rest of the Gospels, and most of the Gospels, are recorded in Greek. There are very few times in the Gospels where Jesus' words are recorded in Aramaic. When he refers to God as Abba Father, his final words on the cross, and these words in this story, they are times where we see the vulnerable, maternal, and intimate sides of Jesus. They're also first-hand accounts, most likely, because they're the words that were actually said, not someone retelling the story. So here Jesus is, and he says to her, "Talitha kalum," which literally means, "little girl, get up." But that doesn't convey the sense of what Jesus is doing here. It's more like when a mum goes in and wakes up her little kids in the morning, not that I have to wake mine because they wake me, but he takes them by, you know, when you just get to go in there and go, "Honey, come on, it's time to get up." It's a very gentle, very maternal, very nurturing way of coming to someone. And she does. You see, Jesus stands with death, and such is his power that he holds this child by the hand and gently lifts her right up through it. "Honey, get up." Jesus is saying by his actions, "If I have you by the hand, death itself is nothing but sleep." Jesus longs to take your hand and call you out of death. Jesus' life, along with his death, grants life-changing healing. It is a healing authority that crosses boundaries, culture, gender, and age that we see in this story today. Jesus chooses not to leave people in the condition in which he finds them. He longs to call you into his kingdom, but it is not a passive task. He longs to to call you into his kingdom, but you have to opt in. While it is an all-inclusive, all-welcoming, all-open kingdom, it is also exclusive to those who take the hand of Jesus when he says to you, little one, honey, get up and come with me. I am not late. I am here. Don't be afraid. Just believe. When I was a little girl, every night I had to sleep with Tilly, my toy kangaroo, and she still sometimes sits on our bed. But I refused to let her go. She lost her Joey. She has countless holes. She spits quite snugly into my arm and is bent because of that. But I refused to let her go. Years later, I received a poem on a card that read, as children bring their broken toys with tears for us to mend, I brought my broken dreams to God because he is my friend. But then instead of leaving him in peace to work alone, I hung around and tried to help in ways that were my own. At last I snatched them back and cried, Lord, how could you be so slow? My child, I said, what could I do? You never did let go. What do you need to let go of so that Jesus can take your hand? Maybe for you it's the fear of being left on the shelf. Maybe it's control of your finances. Maybe it's what you use to self-comfort when you think no one is looking. Jesus wants to take your hand. Will you let him?